Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading this morning from Canto 3, Chapter 7, text number 12. First, a little appreciation about the beautiful Srimad Bhagavatam. The composition of Srimad Bhagavatam is very beautiful. It's like, this is one appreciation that I have, one of many, as with any masterful creation, a composition of music or literature, there are certain points, simple points, that are made in a repeated way, but they're done in such a way it's not boring. It's very creative and something like in a musical piece. I'm not a musician, but something, little appreciation that I have. There's different musical instruments can play a certain series of notes. Like, we'll create one. Boo, 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 boo. And if the big bass instruments go boom, 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 and the flute goes boo, 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 and the oboe and the violin, and so, and then several of them together, and then then they go away, and then suddenly it appears again. Boom, 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 boom. And then a whole series of other things. Boom, boom, boom. So it's repeated because it's important in a musical composition. It's creating a certain, conveying a certain mood and perhaps even a message, a musical score to accompany something. So those repeated phrases of notes in a musical score are important to understand the message of the composer. He's trying to communicate something or convey something. And the Bhagavatam, similarly, Vyasadeva is the compiler. And he has certain messages that he wants to pass on. And so there's some of those phrases I referred to, what we're covering here in the third canto, chapter 7, something that parallels what's at the essence of the Srimad Bhagavatam from the first canto, chapter 7, the realization of Vyasadeva. And it was on the basis of the realization of Vyasadeva that he was instructed, then you compose this literature. So he's disclosing the realization so you can understand what's the message of the literature. And we discussed two verses. Navayovana quoted the first of them. You want to quote it again? That's the darshan of the Supreme Lord with his potency, and means with his potency means also the living entity, his external energy, and his whole spiritual abode, the internal potency. So the Lord and his potencies in their fullness were seen. Purusham Purnam. And then the diluting effect of that external potency upon the living entity. You quoted. What's the next one? And that's describing how the living entity, because it's the topic that's being discussed, how the living entity becomes diluted. So the external energy is under the Lord's full control. He's not controlled by it, is implied by saying it's under his full control. If he says, stand in front of me, it stands in front of me. It says, stand behind me, she stands behind him. And you stand, the external energy is before the Lord, then you can't see the Lord. Naham prakasha sarvasya yoga maya samavrata mudhoyam navijanati. Because of that potency of the Lord, you can't see him. All you think that exists is the potency. And so we have our big material scientists to say that's all there is. That's all there is. There's only one thing, matter. And the laws that govern matter, and that's all there is. There isn't anything else. There isn't soul, there isn't consciousness, there isn't God. There isn't anything else. There's only one thing. That's all there is. And they got there very intricate, very complicated, and very heavily invested and guarded and protected system of knowledge that says everything else is humbug. And that's all there is. There's one thing. Then you got another group that says there's only one thing. All there is Brahman. There's nothing else. They have their very sophisticated, intricate network of describing how there's nothing else but Brahman. And both are features of Maya, we've been hearing yesterday. They're both aspects of Maya. Thinking oneself to be God as the enjoyer of matter, and thinking oneself to be God as, you know, matter doesn't exist and I just dismiss it philosophically. Matter doesn't exist, God doesn't exist, nothing exists but one thing, Brahman, and guess what? I'm Brahman. Hey, I'm God. Very clever. It's Maya. Now, how to get out of the clutches of Maya, once you're in the clutches of Maya. If you haven't noticed, that's a big problem. It's, you know, Krishna outlines it in Bhagavad Gita, in the third chapter. There's this nice living entity, and the living entity is attached to enjoying, and he realizes, oh, that's a problem, I should stop being attached to enjoying, so I should do nothing. We can't do nothing. Because we're spirit, soul, we're active, we're doing something. And you do something in the field of the material energy, and you're involved in the material energy. So you can't do nothing, and you can't do something. What's a nice individual to do? You're, as the phrase goes, damned if you do and damned if you don't. Do or not do. So what do you do? What's the method to get out? So the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita speaks about yajna, or sacrifice to Vishnu. So that's like, that's karma yoga, it's a preliminary sacrifice unto Vishnu. And what's the next verse in that sequence in Canto 1, Chapter 7? Just after the Yayam Samohito Jiva verse. What's the next one? Someone else knows that verse? Chakra Satvata Samhitam. And would you care to give a translation or a paraphrase translation?
The unwanted things which is superfluous to the
living entity
can be mitigated by the direct devotional service to
the linking process of devotional service to the Lord. Then that's the first part of the verse. The second is, yeah, the mass of the people don't know this, and therefore I, Vyasadeva, have compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam for that purpose. So emphasis is going to the linking process of bhakti yoga. Does what? It releases the living entity from from that which is superfluous. What does superfluous mean? Unwanted is different than superfluous. Superfluous is means specifically superfluous. Huh?
What?
Peripheral. Non-essential. Peripheral. It's not important. I mean, some things are important and some things are, you can, if they're there or not there, that's not important. It's superfluous. What's an example of something that's superfluous? Yes? Huh? Hair. Hair on your head. It's a good example. Have it, you don't have it. It's good example. Anything else? You'll get the idea, because the circumstances of life, the material things that people identify with, and this is my happiness, but actually it brings distress and so on, it's all superfluous. The sufferings, the miseries. The miseries themselves are superfluous. We don't need misery. It's superfluous. It may come. So what do you do? It's, you know, it comes and then it goes. Like the winter and the summer season. It comes and it goes. So we don't base our happiness upon whether it's this season or that season, because if you get attached to the happiness of this season, you're going to be distressed because this season is going to change. And we're not concerned about the distress of this season because wait a while, it's going to change. Superfluous. Okay, so I'll read the translation again from text 6, canto 1, chapter 7, text number 6. The material miseries of the living entity, which are superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva, compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth. Sattvata Samhita. Samhita is like Brahma Samhita. It's a term that indicates Vedic literature. Sattvata Samhita is literature in relation to the personality of Godhead, the absolute, the supreme pure, supreme truth, Sat. Sattvata Samhita. Vyasadeva compiled Srimad Bhagavatam for the purpose of providing the means for mitigating of material suffering by hearing the subject matter, hearing a discussion, just as we're doing. So we're taking this wonderful literature that Vyasadeva gave us and putting it to the use that he intended it, to mitigate or relieve us of the miseries of material existence. So again, go back to the question, Vidura's question, why is it, how is it that living entities are suffering when they're in the presence of the protector of the living entities? The personality of Godhead, he's situated within the heart, so is the living entity, and they're miserable, they're suffering. And the answer of how it happened is given, but also how one is it's mitigated is also given. So that's this morning's verse also in third canto. It's just this boop, 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 just being played again by Vyas, the composer. Sa vai nivriti dharmena vasudevanu kampaya bhagavat bhakti yogena. I've heard that one before. Bhagavat bhakti yogena. There it is. Boop, 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 boop. There it is. Tirodhate shanair iha. But that misconception of self-identity, what's that misconception of self-identity? Do you remember from yesterday? There were two things that the Maya, the illusory potency, does. The throwing potency and the covering potency. You remember those? Avaranatmika Shakti and Pratpekshatmika Shakti. The abandonment of our real self identity, or disruption of self identification, and then accepting a false identity, and with that false identity, miseries of the living entity are accepted. It's like a 1-2 punch. Accept this identity that you're not and suffer. So the misconception of self-identity and the miseries connected to that misconception of self-identity can be diminished by gradually by the mercy of the personality of Godhead Vasudev through the process of devotional service to the Lord in the mode of detachment, small thing. The linking process requires, for it to be effective, requires a willingness to let go. Say it the other way. If you want to hold on to your material conceptions of life, like upadis. Remember the word upadi? Upadi means? I asked and you weren't sure yesterday.
False designations.
False designations, very good. So if we hold on to our false designations, I mean, the root of them is I am the enjoyer, but then there's varieties of how I like to enjoy whatever, something. And at different stages of life, we like different enjoyments. So, one has to let go of those upadis, sarvupadi vinir muktam. Muktam, become freed from. We have to have a willingness to let go of those designations. While we let go of those designations, with incomplete knowledge, there's a tendency to become an impersonalist. Like, you know, detachment by giving up those things that can be used in Krishna service. While I'm not this body, I can use it in Krishna service. So this particular body is such and such. So I can use that in service to Krishna. It's not who I am. That's the first part, the giving up the false designation. But although it's not who I am, I can use it. Like Prabhupada gives this example in reverse, when somebody is in an automobile accident. Of course, you never get in an automobile accident because you're a very careful driver. Right? No automobile accidents. Right? Because he's a very careful driver. Very careful driver. But supposing you're being a very careful driver and somebody just comes and hits your car. A common thing that people say is, "You hit me." Identifying with the car. "You hit me." It's just common language. But that's not who we are. We're not the car. And you can go, "Oh, you hit me." But we're not the body either. So we can use the car, we can use the body, we can use that which we aren't. We can use those things in service to Krishna. But we shouldn't identify with those things. This is me and that is mine. We should use them in service to Krishna. They're Krishna's and we use them in service to Krishna. That's how we should end it. And therefore, we're more careful driving Krishna's car than our own car. Just like if someone gives you some money, I've had this experience, I'm going to India, somebody says, "Can you make sure, here's a donation to Mayapur to help feed the devotees for the festival, the Mayapur festival. So, you know, here it is. Here's an envelope and inside there's some money. Can you make sure it gets to the destination?" My own experience is I'm more careful with that than I am with anything else. I may think is, you know, mine. It's belongs to somebody else and I'm just delivering it to the Mayapur festival fees. But factually everything is not mine. And therefore, if we're Krishna conscious, we should be very conscientious with everything that's being used because it's Krishna's property. It's a nice realization. It's a nice way to help get the realization is being very careful thinking this belongs to Krishna. And I can't use it outside of Krishna's service, and I can only use it the way that Krishna would be pleased, and otherwise I don't use it at all. That's Krishna consciousness. So detachment naturally flows from attachment to Krishna. Otherwise, the detachment, give it up, is incomplete because it belongs to Krishna. We use it in service to Krishna. This is, who knows, there's two verses from Nectar Devotion or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu where Rupa Goswami is describing incomplete renunciation and complete renunciation. Who knows those verses? Yes? Prapancha Kataya Bhudya. So that's the next one. But the first one is Nirbandha Krishna somebody. You're giving the second one, but I was going to explain the first one first before we go to the second one. Prapancha Kataya Bhudya Hari Sambandhu Vastuna. Prapancha, it's like stuff. Those things that are Hari Sambandha, those that are in relation to Hari and you give them up, that's Palgu Vairagya. It's false renunciation. Um, Supposing I'm walking along the street and I see somebody's bicycle. I know I have a long walk. But I think, oh, I'll renounce the bicycle. It's not mine to renounce, or maybe in a nice car. Here's a Rolls-Royce car. I renounce it. It's not mine to renounce. What's that renunciation? So something that's not ours and we renounce it, it's palgul vairagya, false renunciation. But complete renunciation is to recognize that same hari sambandha and engage it in service to hari. As the servant of hari, we engage something that belongs to hari in service to hari. So that's yuktam vairagya as opposed to palgu vairagya. That's Rupa Goswami's teaching, because that's Lord Chaitanya's teaching, because that's the Bhagavatam's teaching. And that's the way of devotional service. We recognize that things come from Krishna, and then we use those things in service to Krishna. Except for noisy trucks during Bhagavatam class. We don't use those in service to Krishna. I'll read the purport. It's a short purport. Note that Prabhupada is poetically, he is using the metaphor from the previous verse, quivering of the water, showing the moon reflect the light of the moon reflected on the water surface, and the water is quivering, and so the moon is quivering, although it's not quivering. The reflection is quivering and the moon is stable. So he's using this phrase, quivering, to invoke that misconception of self-identity, the quivering one. The quivering quality of material existence, which comes from identification with matter, or from thinking oneself under the material influence of philosophical speculation to be God. Those are two quivering categories. Can be eradicated by devotional service to the Lord, by the mercy of the personality of Godhead, Vasudeva. As discussed in the first canto, because the application of devotional service to Lord Vasudeva invites pure knowledge, invites pure knowledge. What's that verse? Even before that. Savai punksang paro dharmo yato bhaktir hoksaje ahaituki apratiyata yayatma suprasediti vasudeve bhagavati. That's the one. Bhakti yoga prayojataha janiyati ashu vairagyam gyanam cha yadahaitukam. Devotional service invites pure knowledge, or awakens pure knowledge, or that which is dormant becomes activated, like the match, striking the match, fire comes out. By the process of devotional service, the dormant, enlightened state of the soul, illumined state of the soul, full knowledge state of the soul is restored. And what happens when that happens? What's the byproduct of that? It quickly detaches one from the material conception of life. Kind of like a simultaneous thing. When the room is dark, you turn on the light. And when the light's there, the darkness is dispelled. They happen simultaneously, right? A dark room, you turn on the light, the darkness is dispelled, and you can see the objects in the room. The commentaries by our acharyas go into this in detail. I mean, detail. They use these examples of, without going into too much of the detail, they use examples of pots and plates in a room that's dark. When you're in the room that's dark, you can't distinguish what's there. But when the light's on, you can see the pots and the plates. And then you can use them according to the illumination of the light that's in the room. But otherwise, you can't make proper distinction of anything because of darkness. And in the darkness, you may put your hand on something, but you don't know exactly what it is or how it's to be used because of the darkness. So the light or illumination or pure knowledge that's intrinsic within the soul becomes awakened by the process of bhakti, and with it then detachment. Not only detachment from the object, but detachment from the material conception of life. And what's the essence of that material conception of life? I'm the enjoyer. I'm the center, and everything is meant for me, my enjoyment. I and mine. And there's some problems with that because it's not true. And there's another problem. Everyone's thinking the same way. You get lots of conflicts. Because, no, I'm the enjoyer. No, I'm the enjoyer. No, I'm the proprietor. No, I'm the proprietor. Rah, rah, rah. Kali Yuga. There were some people right outside my window last night that they were like Kali Yuga personified people, just like... They weren't having a conversation. They were yelling at each other about something in a language I couldn't understand, but the energy I could get, it's Kali Yuga. They're just victims thinking, it's mine. And the other guy's thinking, no, it's mine. Just like the dogs barking. Animal life without light, without illumination. So, our tendency to be enjoyers, because we're all in a community of Vaishnavas, we also want to be happy. That's natural. That doesn't become anesthetized by the process of bhakti. But our happiness is in serving Krishna. And fortunately, other members of the devotional community, their happiness is serving Krishna and serving Krishna. And so we can pack ourselves in a little space like this and be happy. Because we're have a shared tendency to serve Krishna. And then whatever are the things that are there, just like in a marriage or in a community or in a family or whatever, you work those things out because we all want the same thing, Krishna's happiness. That's the basis of community life, serving Krishna collectively. And thus, the process of bhakti revives one's normal condition of spiritual existence, even in this life, and frees one from the material winds which cause one to quiver. Hey, there's the metaphor again. So, the circumstances of material life continue when we become devotees. It's not like Kali Yuga stops and comes to a screeching halt. You know, there's the material energy is still going on. But that doesn't affect the devotee because of that detachment from the winds that cause the disturbance and the water that causing the disturbance of the mind. The mind becomes fixed upon Krishna. And so it doesn't become disturbed, although the circumstances provoking are still happening. Here's a nice phrase. You note takers can, I'll say it twice so you can write it down. This comes from the Bhrigu kicking Lord Vishnu in the chest. Because when the demigods, the rishis wanted to test who was supreme, they gave the assignment to Bhrigu. Provoke and see what happens. So first a mental offense, then a verbal offense, then a corporeal offense. They're escalating in degree. And the phrase is, the greatness of an individual must be measured by the degree to which they can remain undisturbed even in provoking circumstances. Or the Prabhupada's way of saying this is dhira. You know the meaning of dhira? You know the meaning of dhira? One who is, remains undisturbed. That's what you said? Something like that. Dhira, thank you. Remaining undisturbed. Are you dhira? Sometimes. Prabhupada's statement is, to remain undisturbed when there's no cause for disturbance, that's not a wonderful thing. But when there's cause for disturbance, and one remains undisturbed, that's a very wonderful thing. And that's possible when you have taken shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You've taken shelter of that which is beyond the changing circumstances we find here. By that absolute shelter, then something in the world of duality changes, and it's inconsequential. Because of that shelter. That's dhira. So become nice Krishna bhakta and you become dhira. Not just some of the time, but all the time. All the time. Similarly, this quivering due to the winds that come, the winds of material circumstance come, the devotee remains undisturbed. Although the surface of the water may move, their attention is on the moon, not the reflection of the moon on the surface of the water. Their attention is upon Krishna. So the material circumstances can be whatever they are. Then, impersonalist. The development of knowledge for the purpose of knowing everything. The jnani who wants liberation that way. I want to know God. I want to know everything because God is the source of everything. I want to know everything. Without rendering devotional service is considered fruitless labor, and one cannot get the desired result by such labor of love. It's interesting he's using it labor of love, because that sounds like bhakti. It's we're working for Krishna, in love for Krishna. But supposing Krishna isn't the object, supposing knowledge is the object, so one can also work very hard for acquiring knowledge. Very hard. I know some people that, you know, they're like, it's like an obsession. They read so many books and learn so many things. They like, you know, want to become an encyclopedia. But that labor of love for knowledge does not yield the fruit. It cannot mitigate the distress of material existence. It's part of material existence. It's also distress. The misconception of thinking oneself to be God or the enjoyer of God's property, that's the root of our misery. Finish the purport. Prabhupada writes, Lord Vasudeva is pleased by devotional service only, and thus his mercy is realized by association with pure devotees of the Lord. Pure devotees of the Lord are transcendental to all material desires, including the desire for the results of fruitive activities and philosophical speculation. Sound familiar? Anyabhilasha dushunyam jnana karma jnanavratam, because one karma leads to wanting to be God by enjoying matter. And speculation leads to wanting to enjoy the position, imagining oneself to be God. So one is to abandon those things. But if you abandon those things, what do you put in their place? What's the shelter? It's devotional service to Krishna by the process of hearing and associating with pure devotees who vibrate transcendental messages, and that those messages carry one to the spiritual position. Last two sentences. If one wants to acquire the mercy of the Lord, he has to associate with pure devotees. Such association alone can, by degrees, release one from the quivering elements. End of purport. Very poetically rendered. So, I think I'll just stop there and see if you'd like to discuss some points or have some questions. Anyone? Yes? They come from the improper use of bhakti? Improper execution of bhakti.
Those kind of miseries, are they binding or are they purifying? What is the impact of
that? Well, a lot depends on how you see them. Meaning, if you see them as an opportunity from Krishna to learn more precisely about devotional service, or look within yourself to see how have I not applied myself properly to the process of devotional service, they're liberating. And if I carry if I regard myself as an enjoyer and try to, you know, I get some misery because I applied myself improperly, then I may get frustrated with the process of devotional service. I start blaming the process, or somebody got in my way, or somebody didn't do what they were supposed to do. You know, it's like what happens in the office all the time. Everybody blaming everybody else instead of getting the job done. Difficulties. It's another way of saying the same thing. It's saying the same thing. It's the Avanti Brahman story, when from Uddhava asks Krishna, what's the root cause of suffering? Whether one's a devotee or a non-devotee, the root cause of suffering is the mind. And if one is fixed in devotional service, some difficulty comes because I didn't apply myself, then I learn how to properly apply myself. It's like, thank you, Krishna. But if, you know, otherwise it's a problem. Why did Krishna do this to me? Or why did another person do this to me? Without looking within oneself and seeing the shortcoming is within oneself. Whatever the circumstance. Yes?
Maharaj said, bewildering situations, one looks to the moon or Krishna. So looking towards Krishna means, does it mean that we take our mind to the instruction that we have received in that particular situation? Or is it that the consciousness is taken to the person who is instructing? How does one shift his mind to...
I was following, as you were speaking, my thoughts were going to the moon, meaning Krishna. And so the first step is you hit the reset button. You know, you center yourself upon your relationship with Krishna. Some circumstance that arises, and I find that I'm in a bewildered state. First step. Rather than, you know, sorting out how did I get here, go right to fixing your, you know, in a spiritual conception of who I am and who is Krishna. Now, you can't do that without the assistance of merciful devotees. So that is, it's part and parcel, or it's a subset of this, it's a simultaneous event. So now,
say the rest of your question.
So that one takes in mind the instruction that have been received with that particular situation which one is facing, or is it that one takes in mind to qualities?
Well, that you may not have received a, life is so variegated, you may not have received an instruction about the particular situation in which you find yourself. So the first thing is, you know, the spiritual identity, and there's a relationship with Krishna. And that means those guiding one on the path to Krishna. So they have that relationship, and I may or may not have some detailed instruction on this particular circumstance, but it goes first to the relationship. And then you consider what are both, are there particular instructions that you say that I know from Prabhupada's Bhagavatam and his purports and those that have been teaching me the lessons of the Srimad Bhagavatam? Are there some particular messages, and does it match the circumstance? You know, if there's some work, brahminical work on our side, to make the match up so that we're clear on how to move. But it first goes to the relationship, and then, you know, then the details. And apply the details as best you can, given the circumstance you find yourself in. Does that help? That's why the relationship is so important. Information is information, but if I'm bewildered, information isn't going to help me. I like go sorting through my information basket, and I don't know what to do. It's not going to help you even if you grab the right information, because that's not how problems are solved. It's not how we got into the situation they're in, is because we didn't have enough information. We broke our relationship with Krishna. That's why we're in the situation we're in. Anything else? Yes?
It is very hard to remain undisturbed, especially in the presence of children when they are being
disturbed. Don't put that in your mouth. Thank you.
Children, it's very hard to...
Yeah, I heard. I saw it also. Therefore, what to do? Think twice before you have children. Or thrice, or four times, or 10 times. But I've noticed there's some more children here. One answer, just by phrase, is the mood of service. In the mood of service, what's the service? The service isn't controlling or enjoying, the service is service. And, you know, when you're doing service for a child that the child wants to play, but so playfulness to a degree is fine. You know, there's times and there's circumstances and there's ways where that playfulness is appropriate and inappropriate. And so gradually, mainly by connecting with the relationship with the child, that the child understands that the parent cares. And so then it, correcting the situation becomes possible. And without that sense of a loving relationship, it's an endless, it's not like, you know, eventually the child grows up. It's even when that happens, it's still endless. The disturbances. I'll share one little visual image. I may have presented this here once before. I think I did. I was in a home program situation where there was my laptop was on the floor and the projector was just on a little raised platform above it, and I was projecting onto the wall, you know, a PowerPoint presentation on something. And there was a young boy, maybe about your son's age, and right in front of him, or very close to him, was the power strip where all the things were plugged in. The sound, the projector, the computer. And he started to reach for the power strip. And he looked at his mother. And his mother went like this. And he stopped. And I thought, wow. Just like that. How is that possible? It's possible because there's love. And that on the basis of love, the discipline was through love, not through anything else. Not, you know, just that's all it was. And he wanted to play. He's a kid. He wanted to play. There's a toy. So he wanted to play. But just the indication. So when there's a loving relationship, then discipline becomes possible. The first order of discipline is loving relationship, without which it's a headache for the one being disciplined and the one who's disciplining. It's never satisfying to either party. Even if there's obedience to the discipline, as soon as the discipline giver is away, it's party time. And that's not what the desired outcome in any case. You follow the point I'm making? Because the idea of raising a child is so they can go back to Godhead, or in their adult, now independent stage of life, they're making all the right choices because they know how to make right choices. And if it's, you know, I'll only behave when somebody's like right there telling me do this and don't do that, when that person is gone, hey, party time, I can do what I like. Because nobody's there. That's not what's the outcome that's wanted. The outcome that's wanted is character. And character development is based upon relationship. Then, you know, I have to have character to show by example what character is. So another way to answer your question is as follows. Think of the enormous amount of patience that has been shown to you by those who have helped to train you to come to a stage where you have some nice qualities. So following that example, show enormous patience. If you just show like irritation, you're going to get a reaction to that irritation, some kind or another. Because the message is not love. The message is, you're an object that it's meant for my enjoyment, and you're not giving me enjoyment. So that's what you get back. In some form or another. Like, you know, a dog passes through a neighborhood. It's like that. So how to enter into a genuine loving relationship with your dependents so that, you know, just that takes care of it. That's the power of love. I complimented the mother later, and she just, you know, said it's all because of the father has brought things to this stage. All they have to do is this. I mean, it's not only always that, but it takes a lot to raise children properly. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Shrila Prabhupada Ki Jai.